Welcome to Samson Stronger, a podcast series featuring stories of resilience from male survivors of childhood sexual abuse and their allies. In some parts, it is heavy going, so if you're not in the space to listen right now, switch to something lighter. But do come back. We learn a great deal about surviving and growing stronger than your past from survivors.
If what you hear stirs up strong feelings, know that you can contact Samson at samson.org.au or on 1800 472 676 or give Lifeline a call on 13 11 14.
What does it take to grow stronger than your past? Childhood sexual abuse is when an adult or an older adolescent uses a child for any sexual act or imposes a sexual threat upon a child. It's a form of sexual violence, and it is a crime. But this isn't a series about crimes or about the criminal perpetrators of child sex abuse. Samson Stronger shares the stories of survivors, the men abused as boys who, with extraordinary courage and resilience, are connecting with support and recovering from their childhood trauma. Not only did they survive, they've found ways to thrive. In this series brought to you by Survivors and Mates Support Network, we'll hear directly from survivors, their partners, children and supporters, therapists, psychologists, lawyers and others about the facets of some incredible recovery journeys. I'm your host, documentary maker Felicity Blake, and my co-host is Rob Carlton, Samson's ambassador.
Hi, I'm Rob. I became Samson's ambassador because I wanted to support an organisation that was established by male survivors of child sex abuse. Ordinary guys who were helping other men like themselves find community and heal and recover from their childhood trauma. Samson is a charity. It's not connected to any religion and their services are free. To kick us off, here are some short sound bites from six male survivors. We'll be hearing more from each of them later in this episode.
I'm Les. I grew up in a small country town in eastern Queensland, and it's only a small town. And look, I never told anyone throughout my adolescence or ever since the grooming process. But grooming is an insidious process where the perpetrator knows exactly what they're doing, but everybody else is oblivious to it.
Where the abuse transpired, it was in not only down at the beach, but it was in behind a church as well. And what happened to me was not good. And then I ran away, absolutely petrified. And I remember running away, and the next thing I remember is the abuser running after me. And he grabbed me and he shook me and said, "Don't tell, don't tell." And I felt really confused.
I've got a really great immediate family, a fantastic extended family, and a really great group of friends. And I had parents who made sure I had other adults to talk to when I was a teenager. So I had all the best conditions to be someone who started addressing these things early in life.
My story is not just centered around sexual abuse as a child, childhood rape, but it was exposed to, domestic violence. It was exposed to poverty, unsettled, house environment and things like that. I'd always known something was wrong around my own patterns of behaviour. I always knew something was wrong, but I couldn't quite put my finger on it. If I look back over my childhood, there were patterns of behaviour which is indicative of a childhood being exposed to trauma. But I didn't make the connection between what was and is sexual abuse and just trauma growing up around domestic violence and things like that.
I lived in a family that was dysfunctional, so I learned a whole lot of dysfunctional messages about being compliant, about keeping my mouth closed, about being a boy that stood in the shadows, but that if people were upset, it was somehow my responsibility.
Gee, it takes a huge amount of energy to portray this whole image that nothing's wrong, that everything's okay, that I'm okay. And I look back on all of that and I think, wow, you know, I had some extraordinary strength to be able to do that.
In Australia, 1 in 3 girls and 1 in 7 boys have experienced some form of child sexual abuse. But we can't be completely sure of the numbers because of what's called the dark figure, the children who never report what happened. Males are much less likely than females to disclose child sexual abuse at the time. In fact, guys often take around 25 years before they tell anybody what happened and seek help for the harm they experienced.
This is Dr. Judy Cashmore, a developmental psychologist who works with the School of Law at Sydney University.
One of the major problems in this area is that we actually don't have a true figure as to what the real incidence and prevalence of child sexual abuse is, particularly for boys, because we know that they're more reluctant to disclose. And we know that there are many people out there, many boys, many men, who have never told anyone. There were some particular cases in the Royal Commission that really went home. I remember the judge talking about an 80-year-old man who'd never told anyone until he went for a private session the next day. And that's when he told his wife and his son. And we don't know how many people there are like that out there and who've been suffering in silence, covering it over, getting on, but also having it emerge and trigger problems for them at various times in their lives. But some of those, the consequences, the longer term effects can come back and come to the surface. And sometimes at times where they had, they really take them by surprise. They can be triggered, for example, by particular life events when they have relationship difficulties. Because child sexual abuse is a betrayal of trust, it's a manipulation by the perpetrator of an interpersonal relationship that they have deliberately groomed the victim so that they will be compliant and they will be silenced, and they will see it as their secret. That makes it very difficult for them to tell and to not see it as something that they are responsible for.
Male survivors of child sexual abuse often speak of feeling like their identity was stripped away by their abuser. Who would they have been, and how would their lives have looked if they hadn't been abused? In this episode, we'll explore the effects of abuse on identity, particularly the way it's experienced by men.
This is Les Spencer, Samson's general manager.
So the grooming process started with just simple little gestures of, I'll pick you up from school, your mum and dad are busy, I'll take you for a drive and I'll teach you how to drive. I'll give you some tuck shop money. Your mum doesn't have any money today. So it was just these little grabs that would entice you. And over the years, I've often blamed myself. I used to say to myself, why didn't I stop this? Why did I leave it for so long? Why didn't my parents know? How come they couldn't see what was going on? And I never told anyone because I didn't think anybody would believe me.
This is Matthew.
So my abuser was a Catholic priest. We our family moved from interstate to New South Wales, and he formed a pretty close relationship with my parents, who really were in a situation where they didn't really know anyone in New South Wales or anyone very much. And it started through that involvement, and the abuse included. Spending time with that priest at various occasions, usually during school holidays, usually at the parish house, and it started mainly by the priest offering, you know, special treatment, I suppose, or special gifts or special time away from a very busy family life, and it sort of developed from there into something where he could take advantage of me, and not only me, I suppose my family as well, my parents as well. And there was no explicit threat that I shouldn't disclose to anyone or I shouldn't tell anyone what was going on. It was a very subtle process of saying, you know, these privileges that I'm offering to you will no longer exist if you don't continue to go along with what was going on. And I suppose that's how it sort of developed. And then it went on for quite a considerable period of time, on and off. And then I suppose in my sort of 14, 15, 16, 17, 18-year-old sort of years, the relationship changed not from a physical abusive sort of one, but more of a controlling abuse where I was put in a situation where I was given a continuation of that that special treatment and I suppose financial inducements to keep on going. For example, he assisted me in, you know, buying a car and a few things like that, which there was a plans at one stage to go on a reasonably expensive overseas holiday that never actually eventuated. And at that time, none of my family or none of my siblings would have been in a position to go on one of those holidays or purchase their own car or something like that. So there was quite a lot of that type of abuse, encouragement type abuse to keep yourself quiet, keep quiet until about the more serious or the sexual assault sort of stuff that was going on.
Here's Les.
The sexual abuse went on. It was almost on a daily basis. Every school afternoon, my abuse continued, not because I allowed it. It's because my perpetrator used psychological. It was not only sexual abuse; it was psychological abuse. Considering that I was actively sexual from the age of 11, it's quite surreal, and you just don't know who to tell because I didn't think anybody would believe me. My perpetrator was a female. And she was a friend of my mother's. She groomed me from the age of 10 and the sexual abuse stopped when I was 16. And not only did my perpetrator groom me, she groomed my parents and my family. So it's a process that they know what they're doing and it's quite calculating. So my perpetrator controlled me. She controlled every aspect of my life, what I do, my friends, who I could see. She wanted me to be with her so often that it actually limited who I could see outside of her circle.
My name is Ryan Chandler and I grew up in the eastern suburbs in the mid-80s and I happened to be very much a part of the surfing culture down there and went to school in that area and I fell into surfing for the best part of a couple of decades and that's where my life began. If you to look at what had transpired in my early years, I was exposed to a lot of violence down the beach, but as a consequence of that, I'd also been a victim to a pedophile within that area. And that's where I'd experienced the atrocities that was bestowed on me at an early age. And I was 9 years of age. And that's where the life that I was to lead completely changed. The surfing was a completely and totally wild period of my life. We all went to school together. We all surfed together down the beach and there was a competitive nature amongst us all, but we were very, very closely knit. There was one thing that I noticed within me, and this would be in my early teens, that I felt very, very uncomfortable. And to be brutally honest, I had a lot of flashbacks during my early teens from my abuse. And one thing that enabled me to not only overcome that but also connect with those guys was to drink. And I was exposed to heavy, heavy binge drinking at a very young age down the beach. And that had a massive, massive effect on me. And I was diagnosed with depression at the age of 16. And I knew there was something wrong with me, but I didn't know how to deal with it. And I felt very, very different to all the guys down the beach. And as I said, the common denominator was drinking. And I eventually fell into drug addiction not too long after that, coming into my late teens. And I remember being intelligent at school. I remember having the ability to surf really good. And in the end, I failed my HSC. What happened was, towards the very end of my drinking and drugging, my past was my reality. And so I didn't know that I was utilizing those coping mechanisms to overcome my thoughts, which were my flashbacks, my inability to deal with my feelings, and also the train wreck of my life that had passed leading up into that point. And I felt as though the world owed me something.
This is Lindsay.
In my mind, I believed that I had been responsible for all this. Had I been a better person, had I been a more compliant young man, had I been a better Catholic, these things wouldn't have happened to me because I was really deserving of them because I was such a bad person. That's really erroneous stuff for a child to have. But in my mind, I was responsible for how my mother felt. And I was responsible for the other siblings in my family. They were tasks that I shouldn't have been exposed to, and they were inappropriate for a young child to take up. But nevertheless, I did. And I have carried that sense of responsibility through in my life. And it's something I now have to deal with and recognize that it is a hangover from the past, and that all I have to do is to accept where I am now and accept the situation as it is. Because for me, responsibility led to attempting to control situations. It led to attempting to control people and manipulate situations. It led to me trying to make sure that everything appeared in a particular way, and that the outcomes were going to come out the way I thought they should have.
So it got to the stage where I could see the only way out of this entrapment was suicide. So after my unsuccessful attempt at suicide, I did end up in hospital. And after the medical procedure, the doctor came up to the bed, to the bedside, and not once did he ask me why I did it. He lacked a lot of compassion, and the only thing he said to me, "You stupid little bastard, you've upset your parents." So at that stage, prior to that, I was actually ready to tell someone because I just could not cope anymore. My school results were poor. I couldn't concentrate. I was drinking. I was smoking. So my life was just in turmoil. And if that doctor had a bone of compassion and just a bit of a twig, what happened to this boy? Why did he do this? He could have asked me a question and I would have told him. I wanted the pain to finish. Throughout my journey, thoughts of suicide or suicide ideation has lived with me. And at times it still does. It's just something that doesn't go away, but I manage it because I know life gets better. And I really would love to tell people who are thinking about suicide because of whatever's happening in their life, I just want you to know that life does get better, but you have to work at it. It just doesn't fall in your lap. Somehow you know you have that inner strength, and I found it. I don't know how I found it, but somehow you do. And I know that you can do it as well. And life does get better, even though today might be just absolutely shit. Tomorrow can be fantastic. And I really would like you to hold on to that thought and just keep pushing through because life does get better. After my failed second attempt at suicide, I decided that I would end the abuse and not my life. And that was the start of my journey away from her, even though she was physically out of my life, somehow she controlled my mind, and I really struggled with it. I started drinking excessively. I was smoking. I was I had a lot of marijuana. I looked for every excuse to ease the pain and escape from reality. But somehow, I don't know how I did it, I still maintained a job. I still maintained this professional persona. But when I was alone, that's when I would fall apart. It was almost like I was full of concrete when I was out and about and I was strong. But when I was alone, that concrete turned to jelly. Growing up in a country town, you have to have this strong persona. You can't be this wimpy, sooky kid. And so I pretended, and I actually used to say to myself, fake it until you make it. And I used to do it all the say it all the time, fake it until you make it. And so I used to put on this tough image. I used to drink and smoke and swear. And being abused by a female perpetrator is just emasculating. It just takes away all your power. I didn't feel like a man or a boy. I was almost like I was an empty shell. It was almost like she had sucked out my masculinity, and I just had no power. I had no voice. I just felt I had no confidence. And so I used to pretend, and being drunk was great because I could act tough. I could just be someone who I really wasn't.
So one of the coping mechanisms, I think, was a complete denial of what was going on. And one of the things that I tried to do, I think, was portray to everyone that it was like a quasi father son type relationship, that there was nothing really untoward with what was going on. And I don't know why I did that. It took a long time during therapy later on to try and unpack all of those sorts of things, because it certainly wasn't anything there was nothing normal about the relationship at all. And it was quite both physically and mentally abusive throughout that period of time. And as a young child, trying to develop into learning how to trust people and trust adults, that was a very difficult thing to try and cope with on your own, basically, because you're not able to tell people. You feel you're not able to tell people because you feel that you wouldn't be believed.
I realized as my life was developing that I was building an alcohol dependence. I realized this because there wasn't a day where I either was drinking alcohol, where I wasn't drinking alcohol, or a day where I wasn't thinking about it. So most days of the week I was drinking. And when the weekend came, it was, in my mind, my entitlement to go and drink as much as I wanted to. Now, the impacts of that were that it just destroyed the relationships around me. My children were not connected. They were angry with me. And all they saw was this sort of person who was escaping responsibility. The gambling fitted into it as part of the drinking culture, if you like. Here I am at the club, I'll drink alcohol and play poker machines and avoid dealing with life. That was the whole goal, to avoid dealing with life's experiences. About the perpetrator, I did feel as though that sense of it's my fault, I shouldn't have been such a passive person, I should have jumped up and down a bit and made more noise. But my overwhelming fears at those times were abandonment, that if I did make noise, I would be abandoned. And I still have some of those abandonment fears that come back from time to time. There have been times in my life when I've experienced extreme vulnerability. Those times were usually preceded by a stressful event, and it could have been work-related. It could have been in the family. It could have been a relationship issue, or it could have been around aspirations, if you like. So for a long time, I had experienced this vulnerability about being a fake person. I would have nightmares about being found out to be a fraud, that I'm going to get my diploma, my degree at the university, and somebody jumps on stage and says, stop, he's a fraud, he's a fake, he's not true. And I would have those dreams for long periods of time. And then they dropped out. I'm not quite sure why they did, but I think it was that sense of being vulnerable at that time to being not a true person or not being an authentic person were seeping through. By that I mean that I became a person who sought to please others rather than actually deal with issues.
And I've often thought, what would have become of me if that didn't happen? Would I be a different person? Would I think differently? And the answer is yes, I would think differently. I would be in a totally different stage. I would be in a different place than what I am now.
I've often thought about what it would have been like had not the abuse that occurred to me, what type of life I may have been exposed to or what type of life I would have led. And I'm clearly of the opinion that it would have been different, and one of the most loneliest and heaviest intense experiences I've ever had in my life is not only seeing the train wreck of my life come to fruition, but also the loss of my identity. And I always felt that despite I felt different, but I didn't know who I was or what I was meant to do. And I was never capable of determining that. And that was reflected in the way I interacted with people, as reflected in the way I was engaging with employers. It was reflected in the way I saw myself through others. And that had a massive bearing on me. And I had an incredible sense of loss because I felt that this is my gig. This is how I'm going to live my life. And it was incredibly lonely.
We draw our identity from many sources: family, culture, community, country. Every survivor's story is different because each one happens in a unique combination of conditions.
Hi, my name's Philip Saunders. I live in Adelaide. I was born in Mount Gambier, South Australia. But going back when I was a kid, I always wanted to be like the other people across the road. I played sport and football and things like that. I wish I'd had a dad that was around. That was part of my life. My dad had left before I was born. So I didn't have any male role models that were healthy in my life. And I just saw what other people were doing across the road, and it was sort of like looking outside the fishbowl, so to speak. And, you know, as corny as it might sound, I was watching Arnie Becker out of LA Law, and I thought, I want to be like him, you know what I mean? He seemed pretty cool, and he was surrounded by sort of beautiful women, and, you know, had a blonde hair and a suntan, completely the opposite to what I look like. And I just didn't want to grow up in poverty. I wanted better for myself. So my first proper job, I was fortunate enough to get a cadetship with the Legal Services Commission in Adelaide. And that was a great introduction to the law. Yeah, look, my working life has been, I've had some really good jobs, and I've also had, part of my problem has always been chasing this illusion of trying to, you know, if jobs or projects will fix me. And that's why I was known that there's something fundamentally sort of unsettling inside of me as a result of things that have happened growing up. During my life, I've worked in Aboriginal communities in the Northern Territory consulting, working as a consultant to traditional owners in the Pitjantjatjara lands, APY lands, Anangu Pitjantjatjara Yankunjatjara lands. I've worked in Alice Springs, in Arnhem Land, you know, people, like, for me, culture is just, it's really hard to talk about in a lot of ways, because it's just in me. It's, you know what I mean? It's like, I think the best way to describe it for me is that a fish doesn't know it's in water. My culture's inside of me. It's in my DNA. It's in, and importantly, too, it's how I think, and it's my view of the world. And it's about my connection to my country. It's about connection to my community. It's about my, you know, song lines and things like that. It's about places that are special. But ultimately, it's in my DNA. My mum raised us in a household where we knew about our identity, we knew where we came from and you know, what it meant and what it means to be part of the community that where we live. And so it's always been my anchor. And I think that when what I've learned over the last few years, that going home on country, going home to my family, to my community, when things have been difficult, has been really therapeutic and healing. And so when you talk about issues like this, I don't want to bring shame on my mum and her relationships of her aunts or uncles or, you know, her grandparents. And that's the thing, because it's not just, I'm not talking about just one generation here. I'm not talking about one person that did it to me. That one person, well, that two people, they are part of the family architecture in my family structure in my community. And so I don't want to disrespect them. I don't want to disrespect my relationship my mother has with their family. And that's the big hurdle at times. You know, shame is like, I'm not, you know, when you talk about these types of things, our family ties go way back, you know what I mean? And that's very different to a lot of Anglo-Saxon, you know, Anglo-European families. Like, I go back, my ancestry, when I trace it back, I go back, you know, 5 or 6 generations. And a strong bond. As males, we need to open our heart up and our soul. We need to have these conversations around these taboo topics. You know, like for me, my own experience, I'm approaching 50 and I'm just getting a handle on how trauma and sexual abuse affects your development. And I know that my neurons, the pathways to my brain were architecturally damaged because of what had happened. I didn't know that I was raped as a kid because I just thought it was normal. And, you know, sometimes I think, you know, is it rape? What does it mean? You know what I mean? And until we really understand, you know, we need to have those conversations.
Here's Dr. Judy Cashmore to explain more about how childhood trauma can change the brain.
When children are traumatised, when they have really adverse childhood experiences, what that leads to is the typical flight, fright, or freeze response. I mean, that might govern how they behaved at the time. It also has a longer term effect. And so when we get scared or upset, adrenaline surges through our system, and that can have a longer term impact on the developing brain too. And the development of children's brains is really critical around their adolescent years, certainly the 0 to 5 years, but around adolescence. And it means that it has a set point. It can have an effect on our set point of the adrenaline and the system and our developing brain, so that when we're stressed in future, we've already got a resting level. That means it may not take that much more to spike us over into an adverse reaction, or what might be seen by others to be an overreaction. So that cortisol and the adrenaline doesn't just end at the time, it can have an ongoing effect. And so the freezing that people get, the triggering that they get when they experience the same sort of sounds or smells or touch is what explains why they can really freak out and be seen to be reacting in a way that people who don't understand what they've gone through, and they may not understand exactly why it triggers such an extreme response, why it triggers that sort of physical and psychological response. So although the cortisol and so on can explain our stress reactions to things, you know, our brains are not set in concrete. They are plastic. And we know now that there are various things that, and our experiences well beyond adolescence and when this happens, can actually change the way we react. But abuse isn't destiny. And by seeing how other men have dealt with it and escaped those sorts of consequences or dealt with those and gone beyond those longer term effects can really give hope to people about, yes, I can do this too. And that sort of plasticity is really important.
So for me, the more I talk about it, the less it becomes a secret. And that's what the approach that I take, is to suck the energy out of the secret and it just becomes a story.
When you become aware that your identity has been derailed by childhood abuse, how do you set about getting it back on track? How do you find your way back to yourself? The path to healing and recovery is rarely straightforward.
But it was actually a process where you actually had to go out and do something. You had to go out, you know, go outside the front door and you know, turn up to a clinic, sit down with a counsellor and start to talk. Those sorts of sessions went for a number of years. I suppose really that first month or couple of months is all about trying to break into that, break that shell that had existed for such a huge amount of time, such a huge proportion of my life, from, you know, from the age of 5 through to the age of 40, basically, to try and, or thereabouts, to break through that shell that I built around everything, to say, you know, nothing was happening. There's absolutely nothing untoward going on here. It took a little bit of time to actually admit that, even, and that sounds a bit strange because, you know, the reason I was going there was because this abuse had happened, and I was able to talk about the abuse in a very third person sort of way. You know, it happened like this, and it happened then, and all that sort of stuff. And it takes a while to get below that surface.
Along my journey of healing and recovering, I wanted to improve myself. I was always looking for ways to become a better person because I knew that I deserved better. And going to university was a big achievement for me. And that just gave me that confidence to take a few more steps forward in my healing journey. And when I had confidence, that's when I made the decision to go and seek professional help because I wanted to understand my triggers, why I got upset about certain things. And even though I still slip up occasionally, I have a really good understanding of what triggers me and how I can maintain an equilibrium.
I kind of understood a bit about the world from a good perspective, and so had the freedom and the separation because I wasn't in the abuse anymore to actually be able to see it through the window of a healthy life and of you know what it actually was. So I think, like I said, I see that as a real privilege, which you know, sometimes I'm surprised to call myself privileged when I think about what I've been through, but I also know so many stories of people who've been through what I've been through in far, far worse situations. So I absolutely am privileged. I really understood that a lot of guys don't deal with it. And so when I got to Samson, I was not surprised that I was significantly younger. And I also wasn't surprised that for a lot of them, that was their first time sharing. And for me, it, you know, I was an old hat at sharing what had happened or talking about the fact that it had happened. And I was there trying to soak up people who had the similar feelings, who thought the same way, who, you know, had had been affected by something which gave them a certain perspective.
I actually ended up in prison 6 years into my recovery process. And for me at that point in time, I felt as though it was more than being rejected. I felt abandoned. And so what happened was when that transpired, I had all my flashbacks come back. I had all the audio hallucinations come back, the audio flashbacks come back. I had the visual flashbacks come back. And I didn't expect that to happen because I'd been in the recovery process. I thought, I've been in counselling, why is this happening? And it was a shock to my system, and I became really, really recalcitrant in my behaviour. And I got involved in crime, and I had this ideology that I wanted to cause chaos in the world. And I ended up getting 10 years prison, and I served a 6 years sentence on the bottom. Two things that comes to mind is that the recovery process is never at an end point. And secondly, being an individual that has been through what I've been through from my childhood in that context is that I can have certain reactions to things that maybe other people who haven't been through abuse may experience differently, and I need to accept that. It's not necessarily the things that I go through, it's how I deal with what I go through that will determine the quality of my life. And so there was a moment of clarity. I was around about, I think I was 5 years into my sentence, and I was staying in contact with a woman who was the mother of a man who I knew, and he happened to be a victim to the same perpetrator as mine. And he reached out, and my family had known this lady, and we reached out, and I was talking to her on the prison phone. 6 minutes every time I was able to talk to her. I'd get as much information out of her, and I'd share as much information as I could with her. Cut a long story short, he went to the police, and the responses by the police weren't conducive to him receiving the support he needed. And unfortunately, whilst I was in prison, he suicided about 2 weeks later. And I remember sitting in my cell, and I was in a cell by myself, and I held onto the bars, and it was of a night time, and I put my head down and I wept. And I'd been not only really traumatised, and I was in a state of, I believe, PTSD, albeit I was quite solemn, but I had a lot of flashbacks that night. And one of the things that came about was, here I was in prison, and here I am sitting with a suicide of another victim. And I thought, this isn't right. This isn't right. This can't be right. And the perpetrator is still out there. And I sat with that, and it was like, this is where resilience comes in. That wasn't about me. It was about making change. It was bringing about awareness that the suffering that survivors and victims of child sexual assault endure is nothing that anyone could describe, because only we know. And now I think if we'll look at the trajectory of my recovery, despite I was in prison towards the end, I saw that there was a change. And nothing changed outside of me, it was within me.
Lindsay can share a lifetime of reflection on his trajectory to recovery.
I am an older Australian. I am a grandfather of 6 grandchildren. I have a family that I love and I'm very proud of. I had often thought about how I would conceptualise my life to other people. And after thinking about it, I have conceptualised it as a continuum, if you like, of powerlessness at one end and power at the other end. And then across that at right angles is another continuum called competence and incompetence, so that you now have 4 quadrants. And in that quadrant down the end that's powerless and incompetent, I think I would put my early life, because life for me was about being a very compliant boy. But as time went on and I got older, I started to move down the continuum a little bit towards more power. I realized that I could do things. I got a job and I went to work and earned money and I started to study overnight time and I started to get more power. And if you like my continuum, I moved towards the powerful end, but I probably was still in the incompetent quadrant, because becoming more power, I started to do things that were dysfunctional. I didn't realize that a lot of the things I were carrying were shields, things to keep the world away from me. I became an alcohol abuser. I became a person that got involved in gambling. I got involved in self-abuse by hitting myself. All defenses to keep the world away from me. When we lived in the country, when I got really stressed, I would self-abuse. I would hit myself. I would damage myself. And my wife got really alarmed by it, and she sent me off to a psychiatrist in Orange, and I had a whole lot of sessions with him, but I never told him anything. I told him I was stressed, but I never told him about the childhood abuse. I never told him about my early life. It was all about having to present an image to that person that was acceptable, because if he accepted that image, I was okay. And that was my criteria, if you like, for trying to live my life. I want to present to you an image that everything's okay. And if you think it's okay, it is. It's all right. What you see is more important than what it is. And you know, even though I was succeeding at work and moving along, I was fearful of the world that I lived in. And that really, I lived that life in fear for a long time. And it wasn't until later that I was able to move into that upper quadrant of being competent, when I realized that there weren't one only definitions of maleness. There were many definitions of it. And that what happened to me was an experience that other young men had endured and overcome and dealt with. And I learned that the journey was a shared one, that I could share some of my pain and I could share it, and that I wasn't going to be isolated or ridiculed or abused for that, but that I would be accepted and seen as a person of some value. So that for me was a very powerful thing. So I put that competence and incompetence continuum there, because the competence part for me was about understanding that life was about being a competent person in terms of emotions, being competent in terms of connecting to the people around me, being competent in terms of how I treated other people, and not being the center of the universe, not being this selfish person that had to keep the world away, that they had to keep me hidden. And I said to a researcher once, or a therapist once, that I think I live my life wearing an overcoat, and the overcoat was the way to keep the world away from me, not to let the world see me, because if the world saw me, it would dislike me the way I dislike myself. I didn't like who I was, so if I didn't like myself, how could other people like me? So it was almost like when I wanted to throw the overcoat off, when I wanted to take it off, I could deal with the other issues. It was almost as if the pockets of the overcoat were alcohol addiction and gambling, and they were ways to keep the world away from me. I do regress, and there are times when I do slip back down those into other quadrants, and they're usually been triggered by events that I find distressing or difficult or remind me of the past, and I sometimes get into that flight and fight response and want to run away. But most of the time, I am much better than where I was. I now seek help. I now talk to people. I now share. I now try and understand what's happening to me and do something about it. So fortunately, I've been able to dispel those issues with help from Samson and other people, and it has been a more joyful experience than what I've lived, I suppose, most of my life, that anxiety and distress about not being worthwhile. So for me, the journey has been one of moving from darkness into a more lighted space. And those quadrants that I'm talking about, that top right-hand quadrant about competence and being powerful, is for me the most lighted space. That's the place where all the joy is. That's the place where I get connected to people. That's the place where it's worthwhile being alive. And I've been able to sort of move, if you like, from being a 13, 14-year-old boy to where I am now, an old man looking at the top end of his life.
It's so important to actually talk to somebody who has actually experienced it also. Even though I didn't disclose initially at work, working there and hearing the stories, I thought, I can actually make a difference to these guys. I can actually tell them about my story. And so that gave me a voice. And when you have a voice, you have confidence. And then you grow. You just become a different person.
What my recovery process is now and what I've gone through is that I ended up having to learn how to deal with my emotions. And I reached out to a counsellor, and it wasn't the counsellor who was a sexual assault counsellor. It was a relationships counsellor. And it was there that I was introduced to the concept of an organisation that was supporting men that had experienced child sexual assault. And the first thing I asked was, who's it run by? And I was told it was run by two men who had been sexually abused as well. I said, sign me up. And I had an understanding, having been in the process of recovery for many years, I thought, if there are people like me having a go at helping others and who knew their stuff, I'm in the right place. And I became open to what they suggested. I never knew, coming into the recovery process, that there are other people that are experiencing the same thing. And that's where my sense of community with my peers in the recovery process enabled me to share about that stuff, because I held on to that because I thought that's who I was. Now, coming into my mid-40s, I'm understanding now that I don't have to do that anymore. And I am now just starting to get into contact with who I really am. And for the first time in my life, I never knew that this would be possible. So the one thing that I've alluded to today is that resilience is something that I must overcome. Adversity I need to overcome. And I'm not one that engages in going to church on Sunday, but I can tell you I've fallen to my knees plenty of times talking to thin air. God help me. I've done it plenty of times. And I'm still here kicking.
Shane Greentree is a clinical psychologist and Samson's clinical services manager.
And I think that sense of identity and label can really change over time, but has a real impact on men that have been abused, particularly going through those, you know, even the developmental stages of adolescence and young adulthood, and maybe feeling like they've been robbed at times of experiences or how the abuse has shaped their identity, but a real sense of hope when they've come forward to get help and I guess reclaim and assert their identity as a survivor or however they may choose to identify. But there's often that real sense of reclamation about, I'm here, I'm not going anywhere, and this is who I am.
This is Brett Pickard, one of the professional facilitators of Samson's 8-week peer support groups for male survivors.
I guess overall, what I've witnessed is that the men arrive, many of them in despair. They, by and large, men have, I think, have very few places where they can feel safe. And during the group, that's what we endeavour to do, to create safety. And I came across this 15th century word actually called respair, which is the opposite to despair. And I think that that's what I see happening in the men, that they recolonize that space that the perpetrator had taken from them, and they become the author of their story as the 8 weeks unfold. So I guess as the weeks transpire, the men gain greater resilience. They become more confident. I guess they get given an identity again, where their identity had been taken away from them by the perpetrator. And I guess, you know, as they have been able to reauthor their story and start owning their story through the group process, they are affirmed, then they become increasingly more resilient and more confident that they're going to be all right. I mean, I think what's really important is that by the men reauthoring their story, they, you know, it's their story now. They are not going to be defined by the abuse. They're not going to be defined by sexual abuse, that their identity is larger than that. But I think that they become more whole, I guess. That's what I see. The men become more resilient, more whole, more willing to, you know, take on challenges that they possibly wouldn't have done before. Their stories become other men's stories as well. You know, they become stronger.
And surprisingly, when they sought help, a lot of the issues I had with relationships started to resolve. And they resolved because I was prepared to accept that this is what life is. I am who I am. And if they don't like who I am, well, that's okay. I have to like myself before they like me. And when I can deal with the issues of my own liking and understand myself a lot better, those relationship issues went back in the box. They no longer became as threatening or as influential as they'd been in the past. When I stepped out of my advocate or stepped into the light or stepped out of the dark, I embraced truth and honesty and justice. When I stepped into that light, I stepped into a way of saying, here I am. I am prepared to be an honest, transparent person. And from that first week, I really felt a sense of, boy, this is great because I'm going to become so much a better person. And as the group went along, it got better and better for me. It felt as if, oh, I've been waiting all my life to get here, and here I am, and I'm with these other guys who I really think are special. Special because we share part of this story. Special because we're together and we can support each other, and special because we're connected to each other. And as people told their stories and it unfolded, it became really clear to me that this was a community of men who didn't really need to hide themselves. They were men who were accepting of each other, who knew what had happened to each other, who were prepared to put out their hands to support each other based on the sense that we're on this journey together, not a one-up or one-down position, but we're here to support each other. I don't have to tell lies. I don't have to manipulate situations. I don't have to make things worse than what they are. I am just me. And being just me was about accepting me as I am. I believe we are all acceptable as we are. We don't need to change. We just need to be honest and transparent. And when we are in that honest and transparent phase, we can show each other who we are. We can talk about the things that have assailed us, have hurt us, have damaged us, and we can take away the power of those events. We can take them away from being incidents that cause us to destruct to incidents that can make us better people. By being honest and open were the greatest things that I got from Samson. That acceptance that I am okay as I am is a powerful message. But I can only arrive at it by being honest and open. I could only arrive at that position by telling somebody else about what happened to me. I could only arrive at that position by telling that person and accepting that, yes, that was the reality, but it's not my reality now. My reality is I want to be a better person and I can recover.
Samson is the only specialist charity in Australia dedicated to helping all male survivors of child sexual abuse and their families. Each year, Samson provides free services to hundreds of male survivors and their supporters. Samson believes that male survivors of child sexual abuse can recover and thrive. Help him believe. Donate today. Visit samson.org.au. That's samsn.org.au. Remember to rate and share this online because it helps others, especially survivors, to find it.
Stronger was created for Survivors Inmate Support Network entirely remotely during the pandemic of 2020 and 21. It was produced and directed by me, Felicity Blake of The Dove Media, with Julie Blythe of Samson. Our executive producer is Craig Hughes-Cashmore. Interview help from Les Spencer and Shane Greentree. Audio editing by Dion Brooks. Transcript assistance from Dr. Anna Camarelli and Melanie Tachanet-King. A big thank you to our co-host and Samson ambassador, Rob Carlton. Very special thanks to all 32 of our participants. Your insights make others stronger.